Good afternoon. This is Vice Chair Olson, and pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I call this remote meeting of the House Ways and Means Committee to order. Ms. Sparkman, please take the roll.
Chair Moran excused. Vice Chair Olson?
Present.
Olson present. Representative Garofalo?
Present.
Garofalo present. Representative Albright?
Present.
Albright present. Representative Becker Finn excused. Representative Bernardi?
Present.
Bernardi present. Representative Eklund?
Present.
Eklund present. Representative Hansen?
Present.
Hansen present. Representative Hassan?
Hassan present.
Hassan present. Representative Hertas? Representative Hertas. Representative
Hornstein present.
Hornstein present. Representative Johnson. Representative Johnson. Representative Kreisha excused. Representative Liebling.
Liebling present.
Liebling present. Representative Lilly.
Lilly present.
Lilly present. Representative Mariani. Representative Mariani. Representative Marquardt.
Marquardt present.
Marquardt present. Representative Miller.
Miller present.
Miller present. Representative Nash.
Nash present.
Nash present. Representative Nelson.
Nelson present.
Nelson present. Representative Noor.
Noor present.
Noor present. Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill present.
O'Neill present. Representative Pulowski.
Pulowski present.
Pulowski present. Representative Petersburg.
Petersburg present.
Petersburg present. Representative Pinto.
Pinto present.
Pinto present. Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher present.
Schumacher present. Representative Schultz.
Schultz present.
Schultz present. Representative Scott. Representative Scott. Representative Sundin.
Sundin present.
Sundin present. Representative Hertas. Representative Johnson.
Johnson present.
Johnson present. Representative Mariani. Representative Scott. That concludes the roll. There is a quorum present.
Quorum is present. Our first agenda item is the approval of the minutes from our hearing on Friday, May 14th. The minutes were included in the hearing documents emailed by the committee staff. Are there any questions or corrections to the minutes? Seeing none, can I have a motion for approval?
So moved. Yeah.
Representative Liebling moves the approval of the minutes from May 14th, 2021. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Aye.
All those opposed, please say nay. The motion prevails and the minutes are approved. So members, welcome back to the committee. And I know we've had varying levels of time off while still keeping busy in between sessions here. So today we'll be hearing the budget agreements reached between the House and Senate chairs and moving them back to the floor. So the finance chairs will also be holding informational hearings for their bills in their own committees. So we have four budget agreements on today's agenda and we'll schedule additional hearings as language is finalized for the remaining bills. The finance chairs have been asked to give us an overview of which House proposals are in their final agreements, as well as what has changed about their bills during negotiations. So we'll start with House File 13, which is the Legacy Omnibus. So Chair Lilly, would you like to move your bill and tell us about your budget agreement?
Thank you, Chair Olson. I'd like to move House File 13.
Great, so with House File 13 in front of us, would you please describe your bill, Chair Lilly?
Thank you, Chair Olson, and thank you, committee members, and nice to see you, many of you on the floor today. That was super neat, and see some of you again here today. Yeah, so we've House File 13 is a legacy bill, and we've been going back and forth with the Senate, as you can imagine, and the governor and the governor's agencies, and we came to an agreement. We had a hearing last week in our legacy committee of the House, and kind of went through the bill, but I'm gonna go through it just to refresh your memory. In 2008, the voters of Minnesota agreed to tax ourselves 0.375% of passing and then passed through a constitution. And with COVID, to be quite honest, this has generated quite a bit of money, and we're up around $650 million that goes through in this year, and then there'll be a bill that goes through next year because Lessard Sam's is annual, so there'll be about another $130 million or so. And as it's no secret from what's been going on, we're seeing it with our budget, but also people have been really robust about their spending. They've been home and buying things, so of course the sales tax have gone up, and these funds have benefited from that. Again, it's about $650 million, and this goes to the outdoor heritage area, clean water, parks and trail, arts and culture, and these investments benefit our environment, our economy, our health, and quality of life in Minnesota. And these improvements just can't be understated. Preserving our natural areas, ensuring that our favorite lakes are safe to fish in and to swim and to drink the water, and the natural areas are improved. And there's quite a bit of money that goes in the arts area and parks and trails. But I'm going to go through the bill pretty quickly here. I don't know how much everybody wants. It's pretty similar to what passed out of the House floor. We did suffer some losses in some of our equity areas that we worked on, that we have positions on in the House. And so that was unfortunate, but through discussions, we were able to find out that a lot of our agencies are doing some of the work that we had hoped and carrying that forward. But so this bill appropriates about, again, $650 million. And so in the outdoor heritage, that's about $131 million. And we stuck very closely to the proposals to the Lessard Sam's Council. And I think people would be pretty proud to see the work that's done all over Minnesota, and whether that's fixing trout streams, habitat, and restoring and protecting a lot of work that's done all over our state. And I can get into more detail if they're specific, whether that be today or in between our visit a couple days from now on the House floor, if anybody has questions, or I'm happy to go through in greater detail. In the water area, again, 33% of this fund goes to the water area, and it's largely unchanged from what came from the Clean Water Council. And there's some amazing projects that are in there, and we continue the good work of working with Farmers of Minnesota voluntarily to do some great programs. We built on that, the Forever Green. There's some new initiatives that didn't, we moved towards the House position on some of the Riverwatch efforts, and this gets kids and youth out and interested in what we do in Minnesota, so we're super excited about that. And a lot of that's up in northwestern Minnesota, and also in Representative Bowe, he carried an effort there too. So in West Metro, there's going to be an effort on that too. So we're very excited about that. Moving on to parks and trails, a 14.25% goes, $110 million goes to parks and trails around the state of Minnesota. And there's kind of peace in the valley, which we're lucky, and that continued through the conference committee with the greater Minnesota folks, the DNR, and the Metropolitan Parks and Trails folks. And again, it's no secret that these trails are just loved to death. And with COVID, it's just been these trails and all these activities are super popular. And we're able to make huge investments all over the state. And, one of the things that we're really proud of that goes through here is like the ICANN program, getting a lot of new people. And we built on that some more. And the DNR is doing a great job with that and gets people out and interested and shows them how to canoe and kayak and stuff like that. So it's super, super neat to see that going on around the state. And that's through this Parks and Trails Fund. And so moving on to the arts and cultural, and about 19.75% of the money goes, $150 million goes to the arts and culture area. A big chunk of that goes to the arts community and arts, from the biggest organizations in Minnesota to the smallest. There's over 1,200 organized arts organizations around Minnesota. So this is the Arts Board helps figure out how to get grants, and there's thousands and thousands of grants that go out. And so we were making sure that these are respecting the changing face of Minnesota, and we've been working with them, and they're really doing a great job with that. And they continue to do that through the conference bill here that you're seeing today. We included a lot of good investments in the zoos around the state of Minnesota, from Duluth down to the Minnesota Zoo, and Como also, and there's Science Museum has some funds in here, and library certainly, we weren't gonna leave them on the sideline. Representative Murphy, make sure that we hear about our libraries, and they do great work. And then public radio, public TV, are covered. We added some new things in the House position, which I'm pretty excited about, a program that brings food to people in the city. It's not like food, but it's breaking bread together and appetite for change. And Representative Jordan kind of led on that. And it's definitely a strong House position, bipartisan, both sides of the aisle. I mean, we're really interested in that. It just seems like it's going to be a nice new addition. But I could keep going on. There's all sorts of exciting efforts that are done with these funds. And I really hope that everybody can look at it. I think the conference bill is, we did have some losses in some of the details. The Senate really went here, some of our more scientific things, whether that be, some of the plastics that are in the water or different things. So we, tires and different things, but we did get some money for the chronic wasting disease, which I'm actually really excited about, some science there. And so hats off to the Senate for embracing that and some of the other things. But it's a really good bill. You can tell I'm pretty excited about it. Please take a look at it if you haven't, and I'm happy to chat. It's a really solid bill for Minnesota, and there's something in everyone's district all over Minnesota. And, some of the discussion we heard on the Senate floor, we moved towards the Senate position on some of the water stuff. So some of our GOP members were concerned about soil and water conservation districts, and we added them in. We kind of think they should be funded a little different way, but nonetheless, they're doing great work, and we're glad they're funded. And this really helps Minnesota. About half the bill is language that's kind of backtracking to, it looks thick, the bill, but it's going back to fixing COVID, issues through the last year, because our arts community and so many others in this funds were really decimated by the impacts of COVID. And so this is really gonna help Minnesota. But thank you. I'll definitely stand for questions. I'm probably talked way longer. I can see the chair is definitely nodding her head and says, not wrap it up, but I'm pretty excited. We had a strong committee, conference committee was, real, solid. And, but, with this COVID times, we didn't meet in person as much as you should, but there's some disappointments, but I think overall it's a good bill for Minnesota. So thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lilly. And I was nodding because I was listening. It was emphatic listening, nodding. And with that, we will move to discussion, and I see a few hands. So Representative Hansen.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Chair Lilly, in previous bills that were legacy with clean water, there was a repayment of the raid on the Clean Water Fund for paying for general operations of soil water districts. 6 years ago, I think it was $11 million a year that was repaid. So is there a repayment provision for taking the money from the Clean Water Fund for general operations?
Chair Lilly.
Thank you, Chair Olson and Chair Hansen. We were unable to succeed in that area. I tried to mention that in my introduction. I think to have the payback, ideally if the surplus comes back, we could repay the fund. The Senate had no appetite, and I'm not sure there was much of an appetite with so many, for whatever reason, in the corner office either. So that was a definite disappointment, but I think, the work that they are doing is good. So it's not ideal, but it would be a better thing. I mean, it really should be funded in other ways. So Chair Hansen, you're correct, but we lost that position.
Representative Hansen.
And follow up, when we lose that position, sooner or later the funds will run out. And so there's going to be a big surprise for people who have put into base funding money from the Clean Water Fund, whether it's in the state agencies or in local governments. So sooner or later, it's going to have to get resolved. And I appreciate Chair Lilly's effort on trying to resolve it. It's unfortunate the Senate refused to acknowledge the clock ticking and the Constitution, but that is what it is.
Representative Miller.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I need to respond to that. For those that were in the legislature back then, if you remember, that $22 million was addressing the added cost of implementing the buffer law. The soil water conservation districts and the ditch authorities, mostly counties, but the ditch authorities said, we don't have the money to implement this. And so we identified the $22 million as one-time money. But of course, what happens is, in government, is one-time money for a specific project becomes, as Representative Hansen says, becomes operating expenses and continues on. And I do understand that that's where they've moved it to. I don't agree, but I do understand that. That $22 million is now transitioned into where the soil and water conservation districts now are expected to get that money in perpetuity. Now, we can disagree on that. We can disagree on where the money is coming from to do that this year. But understand that 4 years ago, it completely fell in line with the whole point of the Legacy Clean Water Fund, that when there's a one-time funding issue that comes up, we can fund it in that way. And so that's why it was funded that way. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Chair Lilly, any response? Okay. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Lilly, again, can you restate for members of the committee the cumulative amount of spending that is in this bill?
Chair Lilly.
Thank you, Chair Olson and Representative Garofalo. Yes, there's roughly $650 million, sir.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you. And Madam Chair and Representative Lilly, not that I would expect you to have this off the top of your head, but do you have a rough estimate on the total amount of acreage that will have additional easements or now be under, that will become state-owned or government-owned under this bill, the aggregate total?
Chair Lilly.
Chair Olson and Representative Garofalo, I did have the exact number and I just can't seem to find it right this second. And right off the top of my head, I thought it was in the 6,000 acres range. And I've got this fancy sheet here, but It seems like it's showing more than that. It gets a little confusing because I think you're referring absolutely to buying. And what happens is, they're preserving and protecting. So the numbers on this sheet show different are impacted areas. But it's actually down quite a bit, just so members know. And I know that's been a concern of Representative Green's brought that to our attention and Representative Anderson on the committee. And perhaps that's what you're bringing to our attention now. But it was, Lessard Sands was acquiring around 9,000. I believe they're down to about 6,000.
Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Lilly, obviously this is a compromise agreement with the Senate. So as always, I appreciate the work that you and others do on these matters while I'm voting no on the bill. I do want to highlight those concerns that every year we add the amount of the number of easements goes up, the amount of public ownership of land goes up, and this is an unsustainable trend. But again, I want to know your heart's in the right place and you're doing it for the right reasons. So I hope I wish you continued good fortune going forward, but I'll be voting no on your bill today, Representative Lilly. Thank you.
Further discussion? Chair Lilly, final word.
Thank you, Chair Olson. It'll be words. It's a labor of love, and I'm lucky to have Representative Erdahl, a former chair on the committee, and so we get a lot of feedback from him and Representative Murphy, and Gunther was a great mentor of mine. And so it's a good bill that, helps a lot of different areas of Minnesota. Please take a look at it. There's some really neat things that are helping your local libraries and just on and on your local trails. You know, the land thing's always tricky. And, I'm so lucky, my wife and I, we live on a lake, and, not everybody can do that. And, this public land, please think of it. It's public land, so people can get on it and have opportunities. And we're preserving so much of Minnesota, and I know, is it too much? And I don't, that's an ongoing debate, but it is public land, and it gives opportunities to a lot of people, like on parks and trails and preserving. And if we can save some, it's not always like prime part, farmland. It's like edging and ponding and turn it into a trout stream or water. But there's some exciting things in here, and sure, there's some easy stuff to kick, but it's a good bill for Minnesota. And I thank you, members, for your time today, and I look forward to the floor. But thank you.
Thank you, Chair Lilly. Seeing no further discussion, Chair Lilly renews his motion that House File 13 be recommended for placement on the general register. Ms. Sparkman, please take the roll.
Chair Moran excused. Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Garofalo?
No.
Garofalo, no. Representative Albright?
No.
Albright, no. Representative Becker-Finn excused. Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Eklund?
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Hassan?
Aye.
Hassan, aye. Representative Hertas?
Hertas votes no.
Hertas, no. Representative Hornstein?
Hornstein, aye.
Hornstein, aye. Representative Johnson?
Johnson, no.
Johnson, no. Representative Kreisha excused. Representative Liebling?
Liebling, aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Lilly?
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Mariani?
Mariani, aye.
Mariani, aye. Representative Marquardt?
Marquardt, aye.
Marquardt, aye. Representative Miller?
Miller, no.
Miller, no. Representative Nash?
Nash, no.
Nash, no. Representative Nelson?
Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Noor?
Noor, aye.
Noor, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, no.
O'Neill, no. Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski, aye. Representative Petersburg?
Petersburg, no.
Petersburg, no. Representative Pinto?
Pinto, aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Schultz?
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Scott?
Scott, no.
Scott, no. Representative Sundin?
Sundin, aye.
Sundin, aye. There are 16 ayes and 10 nays.
There being 16 ayes and 10 nays, the motion prevails and House File 13 is recommended for placement on the general register. Thank you, Chair Lilly.
Thank you, Chair and members.
Next on the agenda is the Agriculture and Broadband Omnibus, House File 8. Chair Sundin, I understand you have an author's amendment. Would you like to move the bill, tell us about it, and the agreement you reach first, and then adopt the technical amendment?
That would be fine.
Wonderful. So go ahead and move House File 8 and then explain that for us.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I'll move House File 8 be recommended to be placed on the general register. And after much work between House, Senate, and administration, I'm happy to bring this chair's agreement for the Ag and Broadband Finance. The House Ag Committee had an informal meeting, informational meeting this morning on the package. So the global target for ag was $10 million for fiscal year 22-23 and in the tails to fund the Department of Ag, Board of Animal Health, and ARI. This is 1.574 million lower than the House target for 22-23 and 10 million higher than the Senate target for ag from their starting point of zero. Well, the base funding for the Office of Broadband is still left in our jurisdiction. The global agreement removed all decisions about additional funding from us. So there is no new funding in this package regarding broadband. It does, however, carry the $350,000 per year base funding for the office. This agreement does meet the target. We have a summary of new spending by agency. The Department of Ag increased by $10.209 million for 22-23. The Board of Animal Health increase of $307,000 for 22-23. And RE had an increase of $800,000 for fiscal year 22-23. We can do a summary of spending by funding sources. We can get that from Ken Savory of the fiscal staff if necessary. But I just assume move on to the House positions that we did retain that we sent up. And the House was successful in getting the majority of the new spending initiatives it brought to conference. And included in the agreement is $50,000 for industrial hemp development, $110,000 for meat inspection program, $220,000 for noxious weed and invasive plant program, $50,000 for farmer mental health outreach, $100,000 for farm safety grants. The House provided $150,000 for the Department of Farm Transition Pilot Program. The Senate went along with the program but wanted to funnel it through the Farm Advocate Program. So while the Farm Advocate Program did get a boost of $20,000 a year, the funding number is higher to account for the Farm Transitions Initiative. There's $150,000 for the RE meat specialist position. That was a position of the House only. We had funding for a variety of pass-through grants. The governor's recommendation for a 1% increase for MDA and Board of Animal Health budget to maintain current operating levels. Some of the things that were modified in House proposals due to the compromising that didn't occur, the House included the full $100,000 the department requested for international trade, but the compromise ended up at $50,000. The House carried the department proposal to increase the pesticide gross sales fee to pay for necessary upgrades and replacement of the department's lab equipment. The Senate rejected the fee increase, but did agree to provide an additional $600,000 ongoing to fund lab capital equipment. The funding for the biofuels infrastructure program is funded at a level of $3 million per year through carving out funding from Agri. This is up from the $2 million general fund the House funded. The Senate came in at $3.5 million per year carve out from Agri, but when we got our global target, they went up to $6 million per year out of the general fund. So the Senate came down significantly from their position, and the House went up. The House did not prevail in the additional language that established the program and statute, just the rider language. But we did get a report back language for accountability and outcomes of the program. So funding for the bioincentive programs has increased by $1.5 million through Agri carve-out. The House and Senate each came in at $1 million increase, but the House provided general fund and the Senate used Agri earmark. Each also had some language provisions. Since the program is has more demand than funding, the compromise was to increase funding closer to the level of demand, but not include the Senate cap on House provision that would allow companies to reapply for funding lost through proration. Okay, the Ag Best Management Practices Revolving Loan Fund was increased by 1.437 million per year and 1.425 million in the tails. This was Representative Lippert's Soil Health Initiative. The House Department joined in on funding the Senate. The Senate sought to increase the funding, but included a grant component for rural septic systems that affected groundwater. There's a compromise to increase the general funding spending to help meet unmet need and direct the department to report back on possibility of using portion of this program for rural septic. This will be important for rural communities and farmers working on soil health. We included $75,000 a year for green seam pass-through grant. The House came in with $75,000 total, and the Senate had $100,000 going in. We did lose some positions that the House had. The House defended all our positions until the end, but unfortunately, we're not successful in getting the Senate to agree on a handful of initiatives, including base funding for the Market Bucks program, the governor's Climate Smart Farms Initiative, the governor's initiative to create a dedicated food handler licensing fee, and language items we fought for but could not get were treated seeds and some of the outcomes equity report back language. The Senate tied Market Bucks and treated seed to acceptance of the Minnesota Pollution Control Agency rule change on feedlots, which is an area that has the jurisdiction in the Environment Committee. So the new Senate provisions that were added, we picked up a few of their provisions. The Senate had two initiatives that were introduced late in the process by Representative Poston. They're both supported by ARI, the department, and the Minnesota Farmers Union. And they were the new meat cutting butcher program at Central Lakes College, $150,000 with a match required, and a new mobile meat processing initiative. And that's $500,000 to be administered through ARI for the purchase of a mobile slaughtering unit. The Senate had a series of earmarks in the Agri program. They agreed to eliminate a number of them, but one that remained that the House did not have before is $1.4 million per year for livestock investment grants. That's not new money. It's just a carve out from the Agri for this purpose. And the Senate had a $50,000 a year increase to base for Second Harvest Heartland for the Farm to Food Shelf program. The House accepted that position easily. Under the equity and inclusion provisions in the bill, I'd like to report that there's $150,000 a year ongoing for Vice Chair Vang's House-only farmer outreach coordinator position. at the department to work with emerging farmers. And $25,000 of this is for translation services to farmers and cottage food processors. There's a $10,000 a year, and this is a house-only initiative as well to fund the Department Emerging Farmers Working Group. And while the House made a direct general fund appropriation, the compromise was allow $10,000 a year from urban ag grants in Agri to be used for this purpose. But that's it wasn't optimal, but that's what we could get. So we also included a rider language that directs the department to work with emerging farmers. We doubled the amount of Agri that is earmarked for urban ag from $300,000 per year to $600,000 per year. We doubled the amount of Agri that is earmarked for farm to school from $400,000 to $800,000. We increased the amount of Agri that is earmarked for the good food access by $150,000. The Farms Transitions Initiative is intended to help emerging and beginning farmers make connections with retiring farmers to help address land access issues. Initiatives to develop new markets, international trade and hemp may help a broader group of farmers and food producers. The legislative report back for the biofuels and infrastructure grant program includes a report on the number of minority owned and female owned businesses and the demographics of the areas served. So if there's any technical questions regarding the summary of the spending by sources, we can address that with fiscal staff. Other than that, I do have an amendment. Could somebody read the amendment? I've got the explanation here, but don't I move the H8A1 amendment.
Go ahead and explain your amendment. So the A1, did you say you have what you need to explain, okay, or you need someone?
It's just two lines. It's a technical fix. The first one is the first line that references 41.20 of the bill. This deals with a siting incentive program that's already in law. It's in reference to that program that was actually added in another section of the bill. Excuse me. And the amendment just makes the same reference in the section that provides funding for bioincentive programs. And on the second line, this deals with the biofuels infrastructure grant program. The only reference to technical assistance was in the rider, and the rest of the language indicates the program will provide financial assistance only. So we're just striking the reference to it. It's a duplicative. So again, I would move to amend House File 8 as follows. Page 8, line 24, delete the first and after 41A.18, insert 41A.20. And on page 9, line 16, delete technical assistance and. So that would be the amendment and my motion.
Thank you, Chair Sundin. So I know there were two member questions that came up earlier, but we'll do this technical amendment before we go to broader discussion. So any questions to the A1 amendment that Chair Sundin just explained? Okay, not seeing any questions on the amendment. All those in favor of the A1 author's amendment, please say aye.
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 Aye. Aye.
All those opposed? The motion prevails and the amendment is adopted. So discussion to the bill as amended. Representative Miller.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Chair Sundin. Thanks. It looks like your conference committee worked hard towards compromise and worked hard through this. That's usually the tradition of agriculture, and I see that in there in the ag bill, and I do appreciate that. I'm really torn overall with the bill. And by the when it comes to the House floor, I'm certainly not exactly sure. I kind of want to, if you will, sleep on it and think about it for a little bit. But I did want to point to a couple things that I kind of have concerns. I know things can't be changed, but I think I should explain, you know, and I felt that I should take this time just to show those concerns. For those of us in the Ag Committee, the budget's small. It's it doesn't change much, and the different pieces of the puzzle are largely there. Sometimes we introduce a little bit more, a little bit less. But one thing that I've definitely seen over the years that I've been in office is like the Agri Fund, having more and more earmarked dollars that come out of that for different projects. And it seems like some of those become, well, they're earmarked because that's the best way that we can compromise when you don't have much of a budget. I don't like that. There's quite a few of those this year. There's also some money that's giving to higher ed. This is my own personal beef that I don't know that anyone else seems to care about, but as small a budget as it is, higher ed needs to worry about their own dollars. You know, the AGREET program, I think, fundamentally is good, but it was also put into place simply because we couldn't get the University of Minnesota to agree to have dollars out of higher ed. So I've said that in the past, and it's my gripe, but I just see some of those things happening here. I don't think that the ag bill is an appropriate place. I know it was the desire of the House majority to show where there's equity and racial justice and stuff. I don't know if the ag bill, it's sort of a stretch to try and address this. Farming is farming, growing agriculture is growing agriculture. And I know that could possibly even be insulting to some people even in this room, but all that does is divide an already difficult industry and label people and single people out and just do things that are not the tradition of agriculture. And so while I appreciate that, some of the money that was dedicated towards showing that I just think is not a real great trend. The one example that I have is I still fundamentally don't see the difference between an emerging and a beginning farmer, except for the color of the skin of the person that's doing it. And I just think that's a bad track to go down as a state of Minnesota. We're supposed to work together, not isolate, identify, and then do programs that do those different things. To get into farming is very difficult for everybody, for different reasons, but very difficult for everybody. And to start down this road and saying that there's a difference between a beginning farmer and an emerging farmer, I think is just a wrong track to go down. So I'm not saying that forces me to say no, like any good conference committee reporter, in this case, an omnibus bill in special session. I understand that good compromise means everyone has a little bit of a sick stomach with different parts of it. And I'm sure that there's people to the left of me that really wish there were certain things in there that weren't there. So I am personally going to, I'm going to lean towards, I always hate to tell where my vote is, but I'm going to probably support getting this moving on, but I don't know that support continues into the House floor. I still really need to digest some of these different pieces, but Chair Sundin, I do appreciate the intent and the work that you did. And I do appreciate your Senate counterparts for coming together. And it looks like you guys did your best to get a bill together in the right way this year. And we can't say that about all conference committee reports right now, but you definitely did it. So I do appreciate that. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you. I'd like to just respond if I may, yep. Madam Chair.
Chair Sundin, yep, go ahead.
Okay, thank you. I do agree with you quite a little bit about the higher ed issue there. And originally it was going to all fall completely on the ag budget. And I think we negotiated it down so there's a match from higher ed. And I wish it was a little bit more, but that's just the agreement that we came up with. And I think it's going to work. And I think there's might be other partners that could join in as well besides our educational facilities. So they're working on that, and I appreciate your sentiments on that. But regarding emerging farmers, I just really love to tell the story about my grandfather. I've referred to him as an immigrant that couldn't speak English, that crossed the river at night and came into Minnesota just looking for a better life. And when he did cross the Rainy River from Ontario, he was met by a state senator. And that state senator actually guided him out to some land that was available and said, pick out 160 acres here and be a productive part of Minnesota, and that land is going to be yours. So that was then, this is now, I understand that, but how we treat people that don't speak our language, I'm very, very grateful that there was a homestead program, you know, over 120 years ago. You know, that's we still have the family farm. I'm very, very grateful for what the state of Minnesota did there. But, and then some of the equity things, I viewed it as a competition between the entities in agriculture that do the producing. And, you know, I understand who those people are. You know, the family farmers, the big farmers that do produce, you know, a lot of the food that sustains the nation, in fact, and provides for exports. But we also have the consumers in some, maybe they're disadvantaged areas of the state for one reason or another. And if we can foster programs that help the consumers buy Minnesota grown goods, all the better. So I think the equity provisions address that somewhat. So thanks for your comments. I agree with you quite a little bit of what you say.
Madam Chair, thank you. And I'll be real brief. I didn't intend to speak after Chair Sundin, but he sparked something that is actually really more a message for everyone from ag producing areas like mine. I had a discussion with a farmer that I work for during the summer a little bit, summer and fall a little bit, and be very clear, there is plenty of work out there and plenty of opportunity for anyone, underlined the word anyone, that wants to come out and get involved in farming. There is, and you can take my word or not take my word, but it's regardless of race, creed, religion, anything. They want workers. And if you work on a farm, you have an opportunity to farm yourself in time. That really is a tradition of agriculture. And just so people realize, there are opportunities out there.
Sure. And just, flesh out a little bit more, but our emerging farmers program, you know, it's also very inclusive of veterans as well. So it's not just about certain communities, it's about veterans as well. So, and the Senate actually came through with most of those agri earmarks, but thanks for your comments. Appreciate it.
Representative O'Neill.
Madam Chair, I just have a real quick question for Chair Sundin, and I'm just wondering what role did the executive branch play in the negotiations of this bill? I've heard from various other leads and other places that the executive branch had an awful lot to do with it, and I'm just wondering in this particular bill, what did the governor's office, the commissioners, did they have any involvement? Were they in the room when you were negotiating? If you could just let the public know what that process was like.
Well, Chair Sundin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. You know, I could have done this as I went through, but I did skip over it. You know, when I went through the programs like the industrial hemp, the farmer safety grants, I've got it here indicated here that, and I'll go through it. $50,000 for the hemp development program. That was a House and governor's position. The meat inspection program was actually House, Senate, and the governor's. The noxious weed invasive plant program, that was the House and the governor, but it was, I know there was support from the Republicans in the House here. The farmer mental health outreach, that was a House, Senate, and governor's position. The farm safety grants, that was House, Senate, and governor. Okay, the farm transitions. Okay, that was the Senate went along with the program, but they modified it to through their farm advocate program. The RE meat specialist, that was mine. That was House only. So, and then the governor's recommendation for budget operating levels of 1%. That was a House and governor position as well. As far as input on the negotiations, I will give thanks to Commissioner Tom Peterson, great thanks, and his staff. But they weren't always in sync with the governor on these programs either. So it's pretty much a three-way input from our side with the House original bill, the governor's intentions, and the department as well. Again, Commissioner Peterson was very helpful.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So if I'm understanding you correctly, Chair Sundin, the Commissioner Peterson was actually in the room or in the Zoom room with you and your Senate companion, the Senate Chair, negotiating. So it was the executive branch, the House and the Senate negotiating instead of the House and the Senate negotiating.
Representative Sundin.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chair. That's in formulating these positions is what I'm saying is the input from Commissioner Peterson.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So Chair Sundin, Commissioner Peterson wasn't actually in the room being a part of the negotiations. A lot of commissioners were actually in the room. There were one of three people in the room negotiating. So you're saying it was just yourself and the Senate Chair?
He was usually present as a resource. Excuse me, Madam Chair. It's been a while. He was usually present as a resource.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. This seems to be maybe one of the bills that didn't have as much influence from the commissioners, but I think as we begin to hear bills through Ways and Means, we're going to hear a very different story. And maybe this one was just less influential, but there are some commissioners that were very aggressive in their negotiations, literally as a third party, not just as an advisory role. So I'm trying to ferret that out because the public wasn't involved. I don't believe our lead was in the room when things were being negotiated, and maybe Chair Sundin can correct me if I'm wrong, but I believe it was just Chair Sundin, the Senate Chair, and the Commissioner, maybe some staff. So, when you do things behind closed doors, it makes it very difficult to know exactly what's going on for the public. So I just wanted to find out what really did happen for the public to know. Thank you, Madam Chair and Chair Sundin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I will report that the lead, Paul Anderson, trusted friend of mine, declined to be part of the negotiating process, but Representative Nathan Nelson was had helpful input all along. I tried to keep him as informed as I could, and I also included Vice Chair Vang. She turns out to be a brilliant resource as well, and so there was. No dark of night behind closed doors negotiations going on. I'll assure you that.
Further discussion. Further discussion on the House File 8 as amended. Okay, Chair Sundin, final word.
Thank you. Thank you for your attention today. And renew my motion to move House File 8. To be recommended and placed on the general register.
Great. So Chair Sundin renews his motion to that House File 8 as amended will be recommended to be placed on the general register. Ms. Sparkman, please take the roll.
Chair Moran. Vice Chair Olson.
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Garofalo.
No.
Garofalo, no. Representative Albright?
No.
Albright, no. Representative Becker Finn, excused. Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Eklund?
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Hassan?
Hassan, aye.
Hassan, aye. Representative Hertas?
Hertas, aye.
Hertas, aye. Representative Hornstein?
Hornstein, aye.
Hornstein, aye. Representative Johnson?
Johnson, no.
Johnson, no. Representative Kreisha, excused. Representative Liebling?
Liebling, aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Lilly.
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Mariani. Representative Mariani. Representative Marquardt.
Marquardt, aye.
Marquardt, aye. Representative Miller.
Miller, aye.
Miller, aye. Representative Nash.
Nash, aye.
Nash, aye. Representative Nelson.
Oops. Nelson, aye.
Nelson, aye. Representative Noor.
Noor, aye.
Noor, aye. Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, no.
O'Neill, no. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski, aye. Representative Petersburg.
Petersburg, aye.
Petersburg, aye. Representative Pinto.
Pinto, aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Schultz.
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Scott.
Scott, no.
Scott, no. Representative Sundin.
Aye.
Sundin, aye. Chair Moran.
Aye.
Moran, aye. Representative Mariani. There are 21 ayes and 5 nays.
There being 21 ayes and 5 nays, the motion prevails and House File 8, as amended, is recommended for placement on the general register. Thank you, Chair Sundin. The next bill on today's agenda is a higher education omnibus, House File 7. Chair Bernardi, would you like to move your bill and tell us about your budget agreement?
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. I'd like to move my House File 7, I believe, as you said it is today. And thank you very much.
Go ahead and explain your bill, Chair Bernardi. Thank you.
Okay. Thank you so much. Today is my great honor to be before this committee and share with you the compromise language between the House and the Senate. Through our shared commitment, we were able to reach common ground to help Minnesota's families and students. And I'm pleased to share with you many of the House provisions have been included in the final bill. Our House Higher Education Bill makes investments to ensure Minnesotan students are able to not only recover from the unprecedented challenges students have faced during this past year, but they're also ready to thrive as they move forward in the post-pandemic workforce. We had three elements in mind this year as we put together the bill. These included supporting student needs now and in the future, improving opportunities for all students using an equity lens, and ensuring we have a strong higher education system prepared to meet the needs of students. Today, I will focus on the changes that are included in our bill. To first of all, to point out, our target had originally been $120 million, and now it is $100 million. And I will first of all go over what the things that are included in the bill. There was a little change in the dollar amount as far as the dollar amount change. Aspiring Teachers of Color pilot project is still in the bill. It got lowered to $3 million for scholarship. And then we also had intervention for college attendance in the bill before at $1.43 million. It's now $715 million. We had emergency assistance grants. It went from $1.3 million to $188 million. And then we still have the Z degree program. It's for new Z degrees, University of Minnesota. We have $500,000 of one-time money in there, and we had $2 million before. And then the student access grant, the debt is now for $250,000. And as opposed to the higher amount before. And then we no longer have the self-loan cap went from $250,000, which is Representative O'Neill's number originally, and then we went to $200,000. And so then I will just share with you the things that are not in the bill this time. And mind you, we had to $20 million less than our target, then we would have really loved to have included these. And perhaps there will be an opportunity later in a supplemental budget in this biennium. One was the Summer Academic Enrichment Program. It was wanted $1 million increase. It remains at $250,000. The CTE teacher prep pilot was not being able to be funded, and hopefully that will be able to be funded in the future. It's a good initiative. The Addiction Medicine Fellowship is not included. We had 529 plan data sharing that is part of that provision was not included in a bill. And then the work study minimum wage study was not included in the bill. And we had some very good compromises with the Senate, and College Possible report is now going to be provided. And there is an increase of $100,000 to College Possible. The other thing that didn't get in the bill is our tuition freeze. That did not get in the bill as well. The state grant program, we have over $5 million of new money in that program, and more investments are being made that will invest in close to 2,800 new students, 46% of them which have incomes of less than $40,000 a year. For those of you that know the details of how this works, the living and miscellaneous expenses in law went from 106% to 109%, and the assigned family responsibility was decreased by 3% for every student category. We have an increase in MICC of $500,000. Fostering independence grants, students who are raised in foster care will now have the opportunity to have their college tuition paid for. We also have small campus aid of $5.4 million to Minnesota State. We have child care grant that has a maximum of $650,000. And then we have a mental health awareness program of $1.5 million, a one-time money to Minnesota State. We also have basic needs hub requirement for Minnesota State, and with funding associated with that of $1 million. And then we have workforce scholarship policy changes, and now each region will be able to come up with an area of study for their region to be eligible for the workforce scholarships. And we also included some more money in that program, and the regenerative medicine grant changes to incorporate some Office of Legislative Audit recommendation changes. So that gives you an overview of it. We also have, forgot to mention, the Hunger Free Campus Act, which is collaborating with our students and having that opportunity for students to have opportunities for food insecurity, addressing food insecurity on campuses. And so that is a major win. And as well as our teacher, I didn't mention it, and it's super important, is our underrepresented teacher grant. We got some more money for that. That was increased to $1 million. That was for our student of color and American Indian students who are seeking their teacher's licenses. And so we get children in the classroom, and we know students do better when they have people that look like them teaching them. And so we split it in two different programs. And then we also, as I mentioned, the scholarship program. I moved through that quickly. I wanted to respect your time. And if you have any questions, please let me know. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Chair Bernardi. Discussion to the bill. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. So, Chair Bernardi, I'm going to ask you the same question that I had asked Chair Sundin. Who was in the room? Because I know that these negotiations were not public, and I was assigned to the conference committee, and of course, I'm the lead of higher education, and I didn't know anything about it until the deal was done. So I'm just wondering, Chair Bernardi, could you let the public know who was in the room, who was negotiating the bill, and what role did the administrative branch have in negotiating this product?
Chair Bernardi.
Oh, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative O'Neill. Thank you for the question. I will just, from the Global Agreement and Working Group Framework, number eight, the Governor, Speaker, and the House and Senate Majority Leader agree that the appropriate commissioner and committee chairs shall work cooperatively to reach agreement within the target for conference committee reports. That was part of the Global Agreement, and that is what happened in our committee. Thank you.
Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, I'm not sure what you're reading from, because that's not anything that I saw in the Global Agreement. And I know that not every single bill was negotiated in that way. Chair Sundin basically described something very different than that. So I'm not exactly sure what you're reading from. But from my understanding, then, it sounds like you confirm that it was yourself, the chair, Chair Tomasoni from the Senate, and the commissioner. Those three of you were in the room, plus some staff, and nobody else was included. I was not included. I don't believe any other conference committee members were included. I know for a fact that no other senators on the Republican side were included, and I don't believe Senator Claussen was, but we'll have to ask him himself. But my concern is all these negotiations were, again, behind closed doors without public view. And this bill was negotiated by three people, the chair of the House, the chair of the Senate, and the governor's commissioner, with a few staff to make notations for that. And unfortunately, we had conversations along the way, but the actual discussion as to what goes into the bill, nobody else on the conference committee or the working group had any other input whatsoever. And again, behind closed doors, and there was no public there was no view of the public discussion of this. So I should say that there wasn't public discussion of this. I'm just going to leave the committee with just this thought. There are three things that I find problematic in the end product. I find tremendous problem with the process, but the end product, you basically have three buckets, is what the higher ed bill essentially is. You've got Office of Higher Education, you have Minn State, and you have the University of Minnesota. And the University of Minnesota asked for $46.5 million. They received 83% of their ask. Minn State initially had asked for $130 million. They reduced it to $75 million. And of that, they only received, specifically for O&M and their central office, they received $55.4 million, which was 74% of their ask. And again, 83% of the ask versus 74% of the ask. Again, we have shorted Minn State. This seems to be a pattern that we focus our attention very heavily on the University of Minnesota. And I would point out the University of Minnesota has other resources that they can turn to if they need. Minn State has two buckets. They have state appropriations and they have tuition. And I appreciate the fact that you didn't freeze tuition, because then they are hamstrung that way too. But I know that there is a 3.5% increase cap in tuition for Minn State. And so there is a restriction there. But my concern is, again, we have favored the University of Minnesota system. You know, they serve about 60,000 students, give or take. With the pandemic, it's hard to know. But the Minn State system serves over 400,000. So 60,000 versus over 400,000 students. So those are my concerns. And there's still a line item in here for direct admissions, which is $1 million basically study to figure out how to send a letter to high school seniors. So we're spending $1 million to figure out how to get a letter to high school seniors to tell them about some of their options for higher education. I think that money could be used elsewhere, maybe giving it to Minn State, since we did short them yet again. So those are my concerns. I'll be voting no. My biggest concern is the process, that this was done with three people, one of them representing the executive branch.
Representative Sundin. Mr. Chair, you're muted.
There we go. Thank you, Madam Chair, and to Chair Bernardi, thank you for your work on this bill. And I don't know how much latitude Minnesota State has for for discretionary funds, but there's quite a little bit of money spent there, and I just don't know if they could come up with that match money that we talked about in the previous bill. If you have any influence over the people at Mint State, please let them know that they're looking for $650,000 in match money. Thank you.
Chair Bernardi.
Thank you, Madam Chair and members. I am, again, honored to be here before our committee. We did have a target, as I said, of $100 million. 56% of it went to Minnesota State, and 38% of it went to the University of Minnesota. And I just am so happy of the cooperative work that we had and the compromise that we came up with. Our Minnesota students are going to be served well by this budget, and I am hopeful for their success getting through this pandemic and post-pandemic and being successful in supporting their families. So thank you very much, members.
Further discussion to House File 7. Representative Groffalo, you had your hand up, but it's down now. I just want to make sure you're not seeking recognition.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. I'm fully informed and ready to vote. Thank you.
Okay, great. Wonderful. So seeing no further discussion, Chair Bernardi renews her motion that House File 7 be recommended for placement on the general register. Ms. Sparkman, please take the roll.
Chair Moran?
Aye.
Moran, aye. Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Garofalo?
No.
Garofalo, no. Representative Albright?
Oh.
Albright, no. Representative Becker-Finn, excused. Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Eklund?
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Hassan?
Hassan, aye.
Hassan, aye. Representative Hertas?
Hertas, no.
Hertas, no. Representative Hornstein?
Hornstein, aye.
Hornstein, aye. Representative Johnson?
Johnson, no.
Johnson, no. Representative Kreisha, excused. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. Representative Lilly?
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Mariani, excused. Representative Marquardt?
Marquardt, aye.
Marquardt, aye. Representative Miller?
Miller, no.
Miller, no. Representative Nash?
Nash, no.
Nash, no. Representative Nelson, excused. Representative Noor?
Noor, aye.
Noor, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, no.
O'Neill, no. Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski, aye. Representative Petersburg?
Petersburg, no.
Petersburg, no. Representative Pinto?
Pinto, aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Schultz?
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Scott?
No.
Scott, no. Representative Sundin?
Sundin, aye.
Sundin, aye. Representative Becker-Finn?
Becker-Finn, aye.
Becker-Finn, aye. There are 16 ayes and 10 nays.
There being 16 ayes and 10 nays, the motion prevails and House File 7 is recommended for placement on the general register. Thank you, Chair Bernardi.
Thank you.
The last bill on the agenda is the Commerce and Energy Omnibus, House File 6. We have both Chair Stevenson and Chair Long with us to tell us about the bill, but being neither of them are on the Ways and Means Committee, I will move that House File 6 be recommended for placement on the general register. So Chair Stevenson, would you and Chair Long please tell us about your budget agreement?
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and members of the committee. I'm happy to discuss the commerce portion of the bill, and then I'll gladly turn things over to Chair Long to describe the energy portion of the bill. In total, we had a target of $16 million over base with $8 million in the tails. We did get, there is a provision in the bill funding a lot salary increases for people who work at the Department of Commerce and law enforcement. that came from a different target, but that's in the bill. We used those funds primarily on the commerce side to fund operations of the department, including the full operating adjustment for the department, additional funding in the securities unit and the insurance unit. That's meant to speed up processing time of applications, which right now are going very long overdue. There's also additional funding for the weights and measures department at $3 million. There are some great finance policy provisions in the bill that are, I think, of great interest to members of this committee and the legislature as a whole. We do have the Student Bar of Bill of Rights fully funded in this bill. That's $266,000 in the first biennium and $284,000 in the tails. We also did include the Catalytic Converter Theft Prevention Pilot Program, which is funded by a mix of general fund and money out of the Auto Theft Prevention Fund, $200,000 in one-time money out of the general fund, $200,000 in a one-time appropriation from the Auto Theft Prevention Fund. There's also the Insurance Mandate Reform Evaluation proposal funded at about $400,000 each biennium. Regulation of debt buyers brings in $76,000 in new fees. And then last, there are a couple of finance provisions that don't that come from other sources. There's funding for the Legislative Coordinating Commission to fund closed captioning of legislative hearings. That's $300,000 in one-time funding from the general fund, but $33,000 ongoing from the Telecommunications Access Fund. And then a one-time appropriation to MCEE for grants for financial literacy education, $300,000. So this is, I think, a really great bill. We have a good compromise position between the House and the Senate. I'm really proud of the work product that we're bringing back and very grateful for all the people who pitched in to make it a reality. And happy to answer questions after Chair Long describes the energy portion of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Stevenson. So Chair Long, welcome to the committee, and please describe your portion of the bill.
Thank you, Chair Olson. So as Chair Stevenson mentioned, we had a $16 million general fund target. And in addition to funding the operation adjustment requests for the Department of Commerce and the Public Utilities Commission, we also had our largest expenditure in the energy section for solar on schools, which would be an $8 million from the general fund and $8 million from the renewable development account. The general fund portion will be dedicated to use outside of Xcel service territory, and the portion from the renewable development account will be in Xcel service territory. This program will reduce energy costs for schools and provide educational opportunities as well to look into solar power for students. We also are funding a solar and community colleges program. Similarly, so the solar in schools program is split evenly between the general fund and the RDA at $2.3 million each. And out of the general fund, we are funding the Community Planning Energy Transition Office at DEED at $170,000 in its first year, and then $350,000 ongoing. We're also going to be paying for the remaining bonds for the Anoka-Ramsey landfill so that solar can be developed there. Those are the highlights from the general fund, from the renewable development account. In addition to the provisions I mentioned, we have a $5.5 million grant to the city of Mountain Iron to expand their solar manufacturing. It'll make it the host city for the second largest solar manufacturing plant in the country. We are putting $5 million towards the state building revolving loan fund to help reduce energy costs for our state buildings. We are putting $2.5 million towards the Clean Energy Job Training Center, which is located in North Minneapolis, $5.4 million to expanding the microgrid research program and demonstration project at St. Thomas. And then we have two renewable development account provisions that were Senate proposals that were not in the original House bill. Those include $10 million towards research at the University of Minnesota Morris into ammonia energy storage, and two additional years of the Solar Rewards Program in 2024 and 2025. With that, I can pause and answer questions that members have as well.
Thank you, Chair Long. So before we get to member discussion, we do have an amendment that was emailed out recently. It's the A1 amendment. And so Representative Scott, to your A1 amendment.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Yes, just a few bullet points on the A1 amendment. First of all, it extends reinsurance for calendar years 22 and 23. It directs the Department of Commerce to seek an extension of the federal reinsurance waiver. And it returns $247 million from the general fund to replace that amount that was taken from the Premium Security Plan Act for both to balance the HHS 2019 HHS finance bill and the 2020 bonding bill. And then finally, it includes the capitation delay language in case CMS does not hold the basic the BHP harmless. So that is the amendment. And you know, Representative Stevenson, I know you said you thought you had a good bill here. This will make it a really great bill. And I know that you carried the original bill for reinsurance. And so I would hope that we would have bipartisan support for this amendment going forward. And I would ask for member support.
So we'll do discussion to the A1 amendment. Chair Stevenson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair and Representative Scott for offering the amendment. I'd ask members to oppose this amendment. I'll try and be brief. First, obviously, my target does not support a $250 million general fund appropriation there. But beyond that, I don't believe reinsurance reauthorization makes sense at this point. As Representative Scott mentioned, I authored a bill to extend reinsurance. It's a program that I have supported in the past that I think made a lot of sense. But the facts have changed, and I no longer think it makes sense for it to continue. And specifically, the federal act that passed earlier this year makes continuing reinsurance unnecessary. And I think if you're going to be a fiscal conservative and look at it this way, it doesn't really make sense to spend state dollars doing something that the federal government is already doing. And the federal legislation guarantees that people's premiums won't be 8.5% or higher of their adjusted gross income. And so I don't believe reinsurance is necessary for the next 2 years. In light of that, I don't think it'd be a good use of state resources, and we don't have a target to support it anyway. So I'd ask members to vote no.
Further discussion, Representative Hertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I guess, Representative Stevenson, I just want to point out why this is a good idea. There are about 155,000 people in Minnesota that are relying on the programs between MinShare and MinCare. And about 53,000, or about a third of those Minnesotans, are not covered under MinSure. So what's important to understand about this special group of people is that ARPA doesn't cover any of their premium costs, and accordingly, their premiums will actually go up. And it's anticipated that they will go up anywhere from 25, 30, even some have suggested as high as 40%. Now, Representative Scott mentioned that the transfer of $247,000 or $247 million from the general fund is important to understand. I think a lot of us, including myself, did not understand in the bonding bill last year that $105 million was taken out of the premium security balance. So part of what we're saying now with the COVID money and the federal monies that have been made available, including what the governor's estimate actually showed a loss of federal basic health plan funding, but that appears not to be the case. So there's an extra $113 million it's estimated to be about $134 million. So what we're basically asking is that the funds from the general fund be reimbursed back to the premium security plan balance, and that we'll have a positive operating balance. In fact, if we do this at the end of the biennium, it's projected that we'd actually have about $57 million remaining in the fund. So we have this extra money. We saw members, most of us, saw that revenue forecasts were significantly over forecast for May. The state is flush with cash. We have the ability to do this. The problem with not doing it is that it will continue to destabilize the insurance market here in Minnesota in the private sector. And what we saw in years past is that people were leaving. And with the MinSure and MinCare opportunities in rural Minnesota, we saw those providers leaving rural Minnesota in a quite rampant way. And when we don't foster insurance competition, we're going to see that those folks' premiums actually have gone up. So that's kind of the highlights of the finance side of it. And we have the ability to do this. It's important, I think, again, to create more competition in the marketplace. This is also important to remember that this is not a reimbursement to insurance companies for their premiums. The actual monies that are paid are done on an audit of actual claims that are made by the insurance company. So, you know, we were the first to do it. You've heard before in previous discussions that 13 states are now following what we've done as a role model. And I think if we continue to do this for a few more years, we will see a stabilization of the industry where we can phase this out. No longer is necessary because increased choices and increased access to healthcare all across the state would be greatly improved. And it's important to make sure that those who are not accustomed to the conveniences that we have in the metro area of having plenty of healthcare providers and access to healthcare, that we maintain competition in rural Minnesota. So with that, Madam Chair, thank you for the opportunity and thank you, Representative Scott, for bringing this amendment forward.
Representative Liebling.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Stevenson, I think, covered this pretty well, and I don't want to belabor it. Frankly, I don't think it really needs to be belabored here, besides the fact that the American Rescue Plan is going to be have a huge impact for people who are not currently covered through MinSure. They can now get covered and have their premiums limited to 8.5% of their income, no matter how much income they make. So the original justification for reinsurance was to hold down premiums. Well, premiums are going to be held down, essentially, for everybody who goes to buy insurance through MinSure. But there is another reason that Representative Stevenson didn't mention, and that is that this has been a big discussion among the Senate Majority Leader, the Speaker of the House, and the Governor. And they did a global agreement, and part of that global agreement was that they would not do reinsurance. So I know that doesn't bind anybody here. It certainly doesn't bind Representative Scott from offering the amendment, but I would just say this is not part of the global agreement. And when I look at the amendment here, too, I see that there's kind of a sort of a fallback position here if the money to keep the BHP whole doesn't come through, and it involves shifting payments to manage care plans and all kinds of things that look like they would impact the Health and Human Services budget. So I think that the simplest, most reasonable thing is just for members to vote no. I frankly disagree with Representative Stevenson in this respect. I think reinsurance was never a good idea. I think we've got better ways to help Minnesotans deal with the cost of health care and health insurance. If we could get some political will to do some of those other things, because frankly, reinsurance, as I'm sure you've all heard me say before, it just spends state money replacing federal money and really is very expensive. It's a very expensive, inefficient program that really doesn't help Minnesotans to the degree that that much money really should. So just ask, really strongly suggest that all the members just simply vote no. Thank you.
Representative Garofalo. Thank you,
Madam Chair. And I could help Representative Liebling when she was discussing that the 8.5% premium cap would apply to the individual market. She used the word essentially. And so I just, if my friend Representative Liebling could just clarify for us, can you just promise us that anyone buying health insurance in the individual market is going to be have that 8.5% cap applied to them?
Representative Liebling.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Garofalo, you know, federal law is usually pretty confusing, but here's the thing. If you buy through MinSure, your premiums will be capped. So if you're on the individual market, you can buy through Minsure. And many of the people who currently are not in the market, they're not buying through Minsure, but they could be. And many of them are probably not buying because the cost of premiums is very high. We know this. So this is an opportunity for them to buy in and have much reduced premiums that everybody will be able to afford. And there simply isn't a reason after the fact to come in and pay the costs that are incurred then by insurance companies, because as you know, when you buy insurance, you're supposedly spreading the risk among the pool. And then when people incur costs, those costs are borne, should be borne by the insurance company. What reinsurance is essentially doing is taking some of those costs off the insurance companies. It doesn't directly help Minnesotans. It just has a promise that they will reduce their premiums as a result of having lower costs. Well, in this situation now, when we have people being able to have a cap on their premiums at 8.5% of their income, that paying insurance companies for their expenses on the back end makes even less sense than usual. So, yeah, okay. That's right. Right.
So, Representative
Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Liebling. So, if you buy the, if you go to the government regulated health exchange through Minsure, then the DFL is going to take care of you. But if you don't go through Minsure, you're out of luck. Is that a fair summary, Representative Liebling?
Oh, Representative Liebling, this is going back and forth between members we'll do this once. Representative Garofalo,
Madam Chair, if I only have the opportunity to do it once, then that's not going to be my question.
Well,
okay, so I understand that we've got three people who were referencing global agreements that were made in closed capitals. With Representative Liebling said that Senator Gazelka agreed there would be no reinsurance. That's not true. You can call Senator Gazelka's office and you can ask them if they've agreed that there's going to be no reinsurance. That's not what they're saying. So if we're going to play this game of I only get one question to ask and members aren't allowed to have a debate and we just have to blindly follow the obedience of three people, then that's not going to be my question, Madam Chair. And Representative Liebling, if that's going to be the case, then I don't want to ask that. But I would just simply point out to members of the DFL who may have a short memory, what happened the last time you guys went around and offered to help people in the individual insurance market? How'd that work out for Minnesota? We sat on the House floor and we told you what you guys were going to do. You were going to destroy the individual health insurance market. And we ended up with people with health insurance premiums of $40,000 a year. And we told you that was going to happen and you ignored us. Instead, we got a Minsure bureaucracy that was naming conference rooms after DFL legislators. I wonder if those Minsure conference rooms are still named after Senator Lori and Representative Atkins. I'm going to suspect not. But you take a look at that. That issue literally cost you guys your majority in 2012, your destruction of the individual health insurance market. And now a program that works, reinsurance, that lowered premiums and is resuscitating the individual market. Members, this is not an accident that the DFL is doing this. This is not an unintended side effects. They are declaring war on the individual market. This is the step that they make so that you eliminate all private insurance and all you're left is government insurance. That's all you're going to end up with. By taking the progressive income tax rate and attaching it to health insurance premiums, that makes no sense. And so now, and you heard Representative Liebling say this, you have to go to Minsure to be protected. You have to. If you want to buy an individual health insurance premium outside of Minsure, you're screwed. And that's exactly what the DFL did to individual healthcare plans in 2013. It's exactly what you guys did then. It wasn't an accident then. It's not an accident now. And you guys are going to be causing a lot of problems, particularly in greater Minnesota, for people's health insurance premiums. And I want people to know, members on this call who are either paying attention or not paying attention, okay, this is not an accident. They're doing this on purpose. At a time when we're trying to recover from the pandemic, the DFL majority deliberately – don't interrupt me. The DFL majority is deliberately destructing this bill.
Representative Garofalo, continue with it. We're just a reminder, we're this is the House File 6 and the A1 Scott Amendment.
Yes,
so
Madam
Chair. So continue on, Chair Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so what we have here in this amendment is an opportunity to stop what is going to happen. Now, members, you're going to get a chance to vote on this committee, and you're hopefully going to get a chance to vote out on the floor if the DFL majority doesn't use procedural votes to block it, right? But this is your chance to stop the bad stuff that's going to happen in the fall. Now, rest assured, if we do not address this problem, there will be a new excuse from the DFL, right? Just like the crime in Minneapolis is the fault of the police. We'll have a new boogeyman the DFL will come up with. But members, this is your opportunity right now to stop what is going to happen to health insurance premiums in 2022. Madam Chair, thank you.
Representative Scott.
Well, Madam Chair, do I get a chance to?
Representative Lately. Well, let's do, how about I go, both you and Representative Hertas have had a question and response. I will come back to you after I get a chance to do Representative Scott Hertas, and then I'll let you go.
Well, all right. I'll take my name off the list. The fake outrage is too much, and I'll just move on. Thank you. Vote no, members.
All right. Thank you, Chair Liebling. Representative Scott.
Thank you. Thank you, Madam Chair. And Representative Liebling, for questioning Representative Garofalo's motives, you just questioned his with saying that his outrage was fake. I don't think it was fake. We saw a lot of people suffer. I remember going door knocking when people were trying to figure out how they're gonna pay $40,000 a year premiums. And there was no fake outrage then. It's very real outrage and real concern about people being able to afford their healthcare premiums. I'm wondering if there's someone here from the Department of Commerce that could answer a couple of questions, Madam Chair.
We do have the Department of Commerce here, I believe. So, Representative Scott.
Who might that person be so I know who to address the question to?
Let me see.
Sorry, Madam Chair, I actually don't believe we have a representative from the Department of Commerce on this call.
We do not, Representative Scott. We just have folks pertaining to this bill. So we have our House Research and our House Fiscal Analyst for be able to ask questions of House File 6.
So let me get this right. We're on the Commerce Bill in Ways and Means before this bill goes to the floor. Nobody from the Commerce Committee or from the Commerce Department's on the call. That's cool. So, Madam Chair, if I could direct my questions to the bill's author.
Representative Scott, please proceed.
Thank you. Representative Stevenson, I'm just wondering, when you were saying that the federal government has come up with a solution for this, and so we don't need to do reinsurance, were you referring to the American Rescue Plan Act? Is that what you were referring to?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, yes.
And Chair, Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And so, Representative Stevenson, what would the American Rescue Plan do to stabilize insurance markets?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Scott, the federal act includes tax credits sufficient to ensure that people's health insurance premiums who purchase individual care will not exceed 8.5% of their adjusted gross income.
Representative Scott.
Madam Chair, thank you. And so that just addresses people's out-of-pocket, but that doesn't do anything to stabilize the market. And that's what reinsurance did and does. And so another concern that I have is that that the American Rescue Plan tax credits run out in 2022. And so, Representative Stevenson, what then?
Chair Stevenson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative Scott. And I have to first disagree with you. I think it does stabilize the market. The important question here is how much money are Minnesota consumers paying for their health insurance? And this creates a very stable 8.5% threshold that people can rely on year in and year out. They won't have to wait for the premium results or rate increases to be released by insurance companies each year. They can know that their premium costs will not be more than 8.5% of their adjusted gross income. So I actually think that that's more stable than even reinsurance, which, as I said before, was a program that I have supported in the past because it was working effectively. But this is even better from the consumer's perspective because they will know that their rate is 8.5%. And as for what comes next, I think that's an important conversation for us to have here at the legislature. And I'm sure the federal government will continue to have it as well. And notably, it was an important conversation to have even in the context of reinsurance, because, of course, our existing waiver expires after the fifth year, the proposed fifth year of reinsurance. Your amendment here would instruct the department to obtain a new waiver, which is an ongoing process. There's no guarantee that the federal government would grant us a waiver. There has to be a proposal and a discussion. So it's a discussion we're going to continue to have. Certainly the 8.5% figure in the federal plan provides great stability and security for Minnesota consumers, and something that we can be happy about.
Representative Scott.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And members, relying on the American Rescue Plan is not good policy. If premiums go up, yes, we're going to get more money from the federal government, because when the premiums go up, as a result, what we get from the federal government goes up, which is really kind of a backward approach to me. If premiums go down, you should be awarded more for saving those dollars. But members, some of you weren't around 4 or 5 years ago when health insurance went sideways. And Representative Stevenson, I don't think you were here then, but relying on something that doesn't really truly stabilize the market in terms of a federal program like the ARPA Act, not good enough. Not good enough for me to ensure that my constituents aren't asked to be paid $40,000 a year in insurance premiums. Members, this is a good amendment. It's reasonable. It stabilizes our markets. It helps those people that are left out, those 50 some thousand people for sure that are going outside of MNsure to the private market. It ensures that they are protected from 30, 40, 50% increases in their insurance premiums. So members, I ask for your support. Thank you.
Further discussion to the A1 amendment to House File 6. Representative
Pertas.
Yep.
Thank you.
Representative Pertas.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Well, Representative Garofalo, Representative Scott, you've hit kind of the high points, and I was here back then, and we saw a great destabilization of the market. We had folks in rural Minnesota that were driving 90 and 100 miles to visit a doctor because of lack of choice, and was destabilizing the market. What was essentially happening with having to create an exchange, it was transferring people and concentrating the risk in the private market, and so premiums started to rise. So this is a real problem, and Representative Garofalo is exactly right. This is really an orchestrated plan to destabilize the market and leave you with only one choice. With that, Madam Chair, I would request a roll call on this amendment.
A roll call having been requested on the A1 amendment, there will be a roll call. Further discussion to the A1. Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stevenson, I've heard this conversation. It's like Groundhog Day from 2013. And you talk a lot, and I've heard others talk about the stability that it brings to the private market, particularly with MNsure. But my question to you is maybe twofold based upon the answer that you support my question with is, if a person is not going to go to the exchange, MNsure, to purchase their insurance.
Have a good night.
What happens to those people?
Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Albright, my understanding, and I think that you heard this from Representative Liebling and Representative Garofalo's comments earlier, is that to be eligible for the credits under the American Rescue Plan, you have to purchase you have to go through MNsure. I think if someone were to choose not to go through MNsure, they would not be eligible for the credits. The good news is, under the Rescue Plan, anyone who's purchasing in the individual market can go through MNsure. So there's no income threshold or anything like that. You are able to get through MinShare and get those credits, thus making sure that your premiums will be 8.5% of adjusted gross income. So everyone has the option of having those that the security of knowing that their premiums will not exceed 8.5% of their income. They just have to go through MinShare.
Representative Albright.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Representative Stevenson, you and I have a fundamental difference about the eligibility for MinShare, and we can certainly debate that ad nauseum at some later time. But in my opinion, that isn't really going to be the case. And so my follow-on question is, how much do you think that without reinsurance, those people that are not eligible for MinShare who choose not to go through MinShare, how much do you think that the increase in their premiums is acceptable to you or to them? What is your anticipation? And I'm sure you've talked to the same people that many others have had that have warned you as well that insurance premiums will be going up. What is your anticipation in terms of what those people should expect?
Chair Stevenson.
Madam Chair, Representative Albright, I would expect that those people would do the rational thing and get the 8.5% guarantee, which they are eligible for. And that would be my hope that they would do that. You know, the American Rescue Plan makes them eligible for MinShare. And we can have, it sounds like you and I disagree about that. We can have that discussion whenever you like. But my expectation would be they would have the 8.5% guarantee, just like everybody else, because that's what they're eligible for.
Representative Albright.
Madam Chair, Representative Stevenson, 25 to 40% increases are not acceptable. And that's what a group of individuals that currently do not or won't, even with the coercion of ARP, participate in MinShare in collecting their insurance coverage through MinShare as anathema to some people, as you probably have heard. I'm surprised at your answer or the lack of one to my question. I just find it really troubling that this majority intends to drive everyone towards government-controlled healthcare with the assistance of the administration in Washington. One final point, there was an administration many, many years ago that decided that the best way to control prices was by placing caps on the increases or the cap on the max cost. Anytime that you try to control the pricing of a product, you can surely expect that sooner or later it will explode in terms of the absolute cost, whether that is taken on as a burden by the federal government or as a what do we do now come hat in hand to the state legislature by insurance companies. You are literally going to drive insurance companies out of the state of Minnesota because whether it is by lack of underwriting, because everyone can get into the pool. And I've heard about the notion that, well, the more people in the pool means that you cover the risk. And then, you know, the insurance company collects all the profits. I got to tell you, that is about the most simplistic rationale that I've ever heard for insurance. Someone ought to go back to Insurance 101 and understand how insurance works if they still think that's the correct response. You are capping the market for profitability as well as operational attitudes for insurance companies. If you want to go down this road, just as you did it and your party did in 2013, I guess we'll all have to help pick up the pieces for the state of Minnesota after you really destroy it.
Representative Johnson.
Chair members, Representative Scott, thank you for this amendment. It's really important, especially for those of us in greater Minnesota, the greatest part of Minnesota. I remember before this program went into effect, the word was you're going to have all these choices on MinShare. The county just west of me in Mille Lacs County is one of the number of counties that only had one option for their insurance. And in fact, it was because of the way it was set up, not everybody in Mille Lacs County that was eligible was even to get insurance because they capped the number of people. We had a lot of people that were not able to even buy health insurance, even though it was a law they were required to, but there was no insurance available. And because of this amendment you have and the program we had, it stabilized the health insurance market so those people could actually get health insurance. Without this moving forward, we're probably going to go back the way we were, where health insurance might have one company providing health insurance, and they'd be limited. It's not everybody can get it. And I do not want people to not be able to have health insurance. It's important. If they choose to get it, they should be able to. But without this program, I'm afraid it's going to destabilize the health insurance market again, what it was 4 years ago when we had people who were unable to buy insurance. So thank you for this amendment and my support. Suggest everybody vote for this because it's that important.
Further discussion to the A1 amendment. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I just want to take us back to, we're hearing a lot of promises about, oh, if you do this, we're going to get this great coverage, and oh, you're only going to get 8% increase. And yet I kind of remember back when we were trying to being sold on how good Obamacare was going to be and why we needed to have MedShare so that we could keep all of our doctors if we wanted to. We could keep going to the hospitals if we wanted to. And then when people got involved in MedShare and realized, oh, whoops, I got to drive past two hospitals before I get one in my in my area to be able to cover. The reason why we're talking about this is because we're trying to force people into MedShare, which means government-controlled healthcare and government-controlled insurance. But there are a lot of people that say, look, I can't afford to be that far away from my doctor, or they don't qualify because of their income requirements and others. They're not going to get that 8% protection. And so that's the people we're talking about. The destabilization isn't just about whether or not we can keep the premiums down. It's also about what's it going to do when some of these programs come out of some of our smaller hospitals. What's it going to do when we have hospitals closing in our communities so we have to drive an extra 20 or 30 miles here in Greater Minnesota? So this is more than just about healthcare premiums. This is also about stabilizing the whole healthcare market. And you may not think that this little portion of all of the healthcare premiums is going to make that big a difference, but it does, because we have less and less people having to cover a greater and greater portion of the risk of the remaining groups that are covered underneath this. So this really is something that is important, something that we need to do. And I also would recommend a yes vote. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further discussion to the A1 amendment. Seeing no further discussion and a roll call having been requested, the clerk will take the roll on the A1 amendment.
Chair Moran excused. Vice Chair Olson?
No.
Olson, no. Representative Garofalo?
Yes.
Garofalo, aye. Representative Albright?
Yes.
Albright, aye. Representative Becker Finn?
No.
Becker Finn, no. Representative Bernardi?
No.
Bernardi, no. Representative Eklund?
No.
Eklund, no. Representative Hansen?
No.
Hansen, no. Representative Hassan?
Hassan, no.
Hassan, no. Representative Hertas?
Hertas, aye.
Hertas, aye. Representative Hornstein?
Hornstein, no.
Hornstein, no. Representative Johnson?
Johnson, aye.
Johnson, aye. Representative Kreisha, excused. Representative Liebling?
Liebling, no.
Liebling, no. Representative Lilly?
Lilly, no.
Lilly, no. Representative Mariani?
Mariani, no.
Mariani, no. Representative Marquardt?
Marquardt, no.
Marquardt, no. Representative Miller?
Miller, no.
Miller, no. Representative Nash.
Nash, aye.
Nash, aye. Representative Nelson, excused. Representative Noor.
Noor, no.
Noor, no. Representative O'Neill.
O'Neill, aye.
O'Neill, aye. Representative Pawlowski.
Pawlowski, no.
Pawlowski, no. Representative Petersburg.
Petersburg, aye.
Petersburg, aye. Representative Pinto.
Pinto, no.
Pinto, no. Representative Schumacher.
Schumacher, aye.
Schumacher, aye. Representative Schultz.
Schultz, no.
Schultz, no. Representative Scott.
Scott, aye.
Scott, aye. Representative Sundin.
Sundin, no.
Sundin, no. There are 9 ayes and 17 nays.
With 9 ayes and 17 nays, the motion does not prevail and the amendment is not adopted. So back to the bill before us. Discussion to House File 6. Further discussion to House File 6. Chair Stevenson, last word. Representative O'Neill.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Sorry, it took me a minute to find the right button. So I'm asking the same question. Who was involved in negotiations? Because all these negotiations have been happening behind closed doors, away from the public view. And Chair Stevenson, can you please let us know who was involved in these negotiations and what role specifically that the administrative branch or the governor and his commissioners have had in crafting this bill?
Chair Stevenson.
Well, thank you, Madam Chair, Representative O'Neill. You know, we had a actually productive conference committee before adjournment, and many of the provisions in the bill were adopted by the conference committee in public hearings before adjournment. We, of course, got our target at the same time as everyone else at the very end of session. And then I think, as is often the case with negotiations, particularly on large bills like this one, you know, your question about who was involved depends very much on the day and the subject under discussion. And so there were a variety of members whose voices were heard depending upon what was being discussed, and a variety of staff people who were also very helpful in helping us understand the issues at play and the differences between our various bills. We did, to your question about the involvement of the administration, you know, I was listening to Chair Sundin talk about the ag bill, and I thought his answer there was reflective also of the dynamic in our negotiations, and that Commissioner Arnold of the Department of Commerce was just an invaluable resource for us, and was present for many, though not all, of the negotiations that happened. Again, it kind of depended on the day and the subject matter. You know, she is a wealth of knowledge both about the functioning of the Department of Commerce and about issues related to financial institutions and insurance markets in Minnesota. And so she was, I think, really helpful in helping us get to a place where there was a deal. I hope that answers your question.
Representative O'Neill.
Well, thank you, Chair Stevenson. I appreciate hearing that. And again, that is such a far cry from the bill that we heard just a few moments ago from Chair Bernardi, as she read something that I've never heard before, that according to the global agreement, it was the two chairs and the commissioner that were supposed to, they were supposed to be negotiating the bill without any other input. And I know for a fact that's not what all happened behind closed doors and other bills. And so I'm glad to hear that you actually did have input from other members as well. I'm not sure who made the final decisions. And I realized that you had both commerce and energy. And so I'm sure yourself and Chair Long had a lot to do with it, as well as the two chairs in the Senate. I'm not sure how much other commissioners had to do with this. It sounds like they were more advisory, and I'll take your word for it, that they didn't actually offer, you know, that they weren't a part of actually making offers. I know that there are some commissioners that were making offers in this negotiation, and maybe yours was not one of them, but we will certainly hear from other chairs where that did happen, where they actually crafted and pushed very hard and were very aggressive in the negotiations. So I'm just trying to determine how much of a influence the governor's office, the governor's executive branch and his commissioners had in these negotiations. You know, this is supposed to be a House bill, Senate bill, conference committee between the House and the Senate. And while we can ask for advice, they should not be crafting offers back and forth. And I know, in fact, that that did happen on at least some other bills. So I'm glad to hear that they weren't actually drafting offers and presenting it to the Senate or however that was working. But so I'm understanding then that it was not just yourself and Chair Long, but there were actually other House members also involved. So that's good to hear. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further discussion to House File 6. Chair Stevenson.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. This is a good bill, a good compromise. I think everyone can be happy with the result here, and I'd encourage a yes vote.
Thank you. And with that, there's no further discussion, and the clerk will take, and the chair renews her motion that House File 6 be recommended for placement on the general register, and the clerk will take the roll.
Chair Moran excused. Vice Chair Olson?
Aye.
Olson, aye. Representative Garofalo?
No.
Garofalo, no. Representative Albright?
No.
Albright, no. Representative Becker-Finn?
Aye.
Becker-Finn, aye. Representative Bernardi?
Aye.
Bernardi, aye. Representative Eklund?
Aye.
Eklund, aye. Representative Hansen?
Aye.
Hansen, aye. Representative Hassan?
Hassan, aye.
Hassan, aye. Representative Hertas?
Hertas, no.
Hertas, no. Representative Hornstein?
Hornstein, aye.
Hornstein, aye. Representative Johnson?
Johnson, no.
Johnson, no. Representative Kreisha, excused. Representative Liebling? Representative Liebling? Representative Lilly?
Lilly, aye.
Lilly, aye. Representative Mariani?
Mariani, aye.
Mariani, aye. Representative Marquardt?
Marquardt, aye.
Marquardt, aye. Representative Miller?
Miller, no.
Miller, no. Representative Nash?
Nash, no.
Nash, no. Representative Nelson, excused. Representative Noor?
Noor, aye.
Noor, aye. Representative O'Neill?
O'Neill, no.
O'Neill, no. Representative Pawlowski?
Pawlowski, aye.
Pawlowski, aye. Representative Petersburg?
Petersburg, aye. No, excuse me. Petersburg, no. Sorry about that.
Petersburg, no. Representative Pinto?
Pinto, aye.
Pinto, aye. Representative Schumacher?
Schumacher, no.
Schumacher, no. Representative Schultz?
Schultz, aye.
Schultz, aye. Representative Scott?
No.
Scott, no. Representative Sundin?
Sundin, aye.
Sundin, aye. Representative Liebling?
Aye.
Liebling, aye. There are 16 ayes and 10 nays.
There being 16 ayes and 10 nays, the motion prevails and House File 6 is recommended for placement on the general register. Thank you, Chair Stevenson and Chair Long for joining the committee today. Representative Garofalo.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And really quickly, in light of the fact that we're meeting in person on the House floor now, do you know, are there any plans for us to return to normal in-person committee meetings and reviewing these bills?
Representative Garofalo, that's a good question. And I know Chair Moran isn't here. And so the only announcement I had is just to continue to watch your email, because as budget bills become agreed to, we'll have more hearings, obviously. And from what I understand, we'll continue to be using Zoom. So just continue to plan accordingly, unless you hear otherwise from Chair Moran.
Okay. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Yep, you're welcome. So with that, that is everything on our agenda for today. So as I mentioned, just keep watching your email. As more agreements are finalized, we'll have more ways and means hearings, and we will continue to notify you. The staff will notify you via email. So with that, we are adjourned.